You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
So I have to say, you're the most Facebook person I know.
Really?
Wow. do you do anything else?
Oh my gosh,
here?
Yes, I do, I do. But yeah, I do post a lot. I put the kids especially. Yeah.
But you know, all tons of stuff, and you share a lot of things.
I do share, yeah. I mean, it's funny, I the bar is different. I have friends of mine that I wish would shut up, who do more than me even, so. Hello and welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I should say it's now a monthly podcast because we have a partner podcast in the other slot. Three on the Aisle with three esteemed critics is now we're alternating with. So Off Script's going to come at you monthly. We have a fun show today, our season preview show. Even though the season has begun, we are going to also look ahead at what's yet to come. And I'm here with
Russ Demmon, Managing Editor.
And Frank Rizzo.
And I am Rob Weiner Kent, Editor-in-Chief of American Theater. Neglected to say that. So we're going to talk a little bit about the season preview, our season preview issue, our October issue, which is the biggest issue of the year. We did a podcast to announce the big news in it, which is the top 10 plays and top 10 most produced playwrights. We talked a little bit about the season, but we didn't go into any depth. And we're not going to go into great depth now. We're just going to glance at different parts of it. Frank Rizzo's here. He's a long time critic and a reporter, covering mostly New England. Is that right, Frank?
Connecticut, New England, and New York now.
Right, New York now. Are you based here now?
I'm based both in New Haven and New York.
All right, okay. On that train a lot, I imagine. Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah. For New York, it's mostly reviewing for Variety.
Okay, great. I remember seeing your reviews in Variety over many years. So. And you're here also because you did a wonderful Q&A with the current artistic director of and head of Yale Drama School and Yale Repertory, James Bundy.
Who just got reappointed for an unprecedented fourth term.
Right, he's the Roosevelt of Yale Rep.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the season. It's an interesting season. It's interesting to me that Shakespeare in Love, a play that, hasn't made it to New York yet. But it's certainly not an underdog because it's a big popular film. It's got Disney behind it. But it's not a play usually it's a handicap to not have a production in New York first.
I'm shocked by that. Yeah. It's a huge cast, so I'm sure that's one of the, not huge, but
it's pretty big, yeah.
It's
yeah,
not
16
a,
or something like
not
that.
A
yeah.
five-hander.
No.
And but it's got wonderful buzz in terms of its production in England.
Yeah.
And I thought it was surely going to be straight to Broadway, but
right.
It never happened. And I'm just so glad that there's smart regional theaters around the country have just seized on it. But it was, a strategic decision on the producers to let that happen.
Yeah, I think so. I think I'm not sure exactly how these things are decided, but I do think it's a large cast. And although the buzz was positive, the New York Times review, for instance, was not a money review. It wasn't like a must-see, bring it over right now. And so I think Disney is one of the co-licensors of the script.
Samuel French licenses it on behalf of Disney.
And yeah. I think Disney's just holding fire and maybe waiting to see. It is interesting, though, that most of the country will see this play before it comes to New York.
Yes.
And that if usually this list... being at the top of this list is sort of a ratification, like a stamp, like now go forth and multiply in every theater. That still might happen because it's not every theater in the country.
Yeah, and it's a piece that seems born for the stage because
right.
There's all that, all those in-jokes, and of course it has a pretty substantial theatrical pedigree
right.
with the film being co-written by Tom Stoppard.
Yeah.
And it just fits well on stage.
And it appeals to a large demographic,
yes.
large market.
Yes.
So, yes, you have the Tom Stoppard, but people love the movie.
Yes.
It's a way of getting Shakespeare, but, you know.
Without Shakespeare.
Without Shakespeare.
Yes.
So I think it's, destined to have a lot of interest and a lot of support. And I think that's probably Disney's strategy, just mm-hmm. to have, which is a great way to come into New York when where audiences demand that it comes in, as
yes.
opposed to producers who wishfully think that they're going to be beloved in New York.
Yeah, sure.
Right, and certainly there are plenty of classical theater companies in New York that would do well with a piece like that.
That's
so
possible.
We'll see.
I think I mentioned before at the podcast, there are 23 member theaters, TCG member theaters across the country that have Shakespeare in their name.
Right.
And that one of the first places that did the play was Oregon Shakespeare Festival. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of a brand. It's a brand. Basically, Shakespeare's a brand. We got to acknowledge that. And there's, of course, as we've mentioned, many fictional Shakespeare's. There's that Will series. There's came up with a good idea for a recommendation I'll mention later about my favorite fictional Shakespeare show.
Yes, we'll look forward to that. Yes. As that's the theme of today's talk. We're looking forward to things as a season preview. As we mentioned during our Facebook Live / podcast, Lauren Gunderson, who is the most produced playwright in the country, has the Book of Will, another play sort of with Shakespeare's name in the title.
So that's at the top of the list. I'm also gratified to see that, you know, the other big public revolutionary musical from the public theater, Fun Home, which is, it was something of a hit, I would say, on Broadway.
I think it at least broke even.
And it was really, really had a lot of impact. And it's on a basically a tour. I don't think these are independent productions around the country.
It's a
tour with different houses. But that's our number two play. That's gratifying to see. That's out in the country. That's like part of the musical theater canon. It's striking that was the first, I believe, all female musical writing team that won the Tony. Is that correct?
Yep.
So, you know, even apart from its sort of revolutionary themes, it's just the fact that it's female writers getting that much.
And it's on many presenting houses' Broadway series. Usually plays it very safe, very middle of the road, and yes, it won the Tony, but it's still a bit of a challenging piece for a traditional subscription-based presenting house audience. And I've seen it on tour. I saw it in Hartford, and audiences loved it there. Yeah. And I think that shows a lot of markets and a lot of theaters around the country that just do it.
So you saw it in the Hartford stage in that main space?
Not at Hartford stage, at the Bushnell, which is a presenting house.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about the one thing that...
It was their national tour.
One thing that really worked here was the intimacy of it. And then around, I don't know if they were able to preserve the intimacy.
The answer is no.
No.
Not really. But it's surprisingly what the presenting houses do and what audiences accept. I saw Love Letters at a 2,800 seat house. That was my running joke for years. and then Ali McGraw and Ryan O'Neill came and did Love Letters, and they were playing to a house of 2,800 people. But even with a large house, the work is so emotionally strong, and the music is wonderful, and the characters are terrific. It still resonates. It doesn't have all the bells and whistles that a Phantom has, but it has the emotional power.
Right. I remember seeing Carolina Change here in New York and also in Los Angeles in a giant Amundsen Theater, which is sort of a barn. It's a nice barn, but it's big, and it worked beautifully there. Another Jeanine Tesori musical where you'd think that intimacy would be the be-all, end-all, but it really it's a strong piece that worked in a big space. Speaking of female playwrights, Skeleton Crew is our number three most produced play, which is very gratifying. I think we can say our December issue, we're going to publish Dominique Morisseau's next play after that Pipeline. But Skeleton Crew had a extended run, I think a return engagement at the Atlantic. It came back two runs in a row. Maybe I'm just confusing that with an extra long run. And that's another one that people compared a lot to Sweat in terms of it being about a working class, a class-based, it's in a factory, there's a drama, and there's interpersonal shenanigans that go on. So that's another gratifying one to see there. I will say, I think as I mentioned, one thing we didn't talk about at the top 10 and top 20 news event was we also released online with this a gender count of what the gender of playwrights is. And it's still stubbornly about 25%, 26% female authored works versus 62 male authored. And the rest are sort of, we consider co-authored by different genders, which is terrible, a terrible statistic. But if you look at the new play sector, the number's going up in terms of parity. And if you look at the top five most produced plays of this coming season, this is the glass half full way to look at it.
Yeah.
And not quite even half full, obviously, but it's an optimistic way. You look at the top five, this could be the future. It's all living playwrights, and it's three out of the five are women. Yeah. So,
well, part of it is that some of the best writing, some of the most exciting writing, just happens to be by women. Yeah. Right now.
Right.
And I'd like to think it's because regional theaters are embracing the idea of diversity, but I think they're also seeing that there are a lot of hot shows out there.
Yeah. Yeah.
That just happen to be written by women.
Yeah.
So hopefully there's a bit of a mix in there. Some regional theaters have really embraced the idea of a commitment, not only for women playwrights, but those women directors, yeah, crew members,
right,
administration, even board members.
Yeah, yeah.
And others are not.
Yeah.
And Rob was mentioning that three of the top five most produced playwrights in the country are women.
Mm-hmm.
It's also worth noting that five of the top 10 most produced plays are by women.
Right. Yeah. I was looking at did I have that wrong? The five of the most produced playwrights.
Three of the five
are women.
And then five of the 10 for the most produced plays.
Right. Right. That's true.
Because it's Fun Home, Skeleton Crew, A Raisin in the Sun coming back.
Yeah,
Miss Bennett, Christmas at Pemberley, and Sense and Sensibility.
I mean, it's not, again, we can't gloss over the fact that there's still a preponderance of male authors, and
absolutely,
this is not just it's not just because we're doing too many classics. In fact, if you look at another statistic I look at is there are many more new plays done at American theaters than,
yes,
classics or revivals, which is a striking statistic. People don't really believe that, but if you look at the numbers, it's something,
yeah,
like out of about 1,900 productions, 1,200 are new plays. And I define new plays as written in the last 10 years or so.
And Rob, just remind our listeners what our criteria are for what makes a new play. What are we considering?
Written in the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then we call revivals written since in the last 50 years, 50 years before that, 40 years before that. Is that right? 40 years. Got to do the math here. Yeah, 40 years before that, so 67 to 2006.
Yep.
And then before that, we considered a classic. It's a rough, crude guide, but it helps us.
Mm-hmm.
Helps us, because in revivals, there's also a case to be made that there were already a lot of wonderful plays by women in the 60s and 70s, and we should be looking at those. And even before,
yeah,
that, of course.
And in 2015, that October issue, we had that magnificent piece, The Other Canon,
yes,
looking at classics by female authors.
Yeah. Right, I noticed in our season preview, I did a search for, there's no plays by Afra Ben even scheduled.
Right.
At TCC member theaters, at,
yes,
least. There are other theaters that are doing it. But, that's low-hanging fruit, people. You can do Afra Ben in place of... you can also do, John Ford or Marlowe instead of Shakespeare. But that's another discussion.
Sure.
Speaking of theaters that are embracing that, I wanted to just ask you a little bit about your profile with Q&A with James Bundy.
Well, James Bundy is a perfect example of an artistic leader who has embraced not just verbally, but really committed to the idea of diversity and equity,
uh-huh,
and not just in a token way for one season,
mm-hmm,
but consistently throughout his entire tenure, and actually last few years more than ever.
Right.
He also extends it into the directing field, those who direct, as well as the design field. But because he's also the dean of the Yale School of Drama, he's committed to bringing that sensibility into the classroom as well.
Right. I was really struck by not just diversity in hiring, but also his commitment to lowering student debt and having that low, which is...
That's extraordinary, what he's done with that.
Right.
And we can only look, over at the Yale-Harvard thing.
you can look over at Harvard.
But, take that, Harvard. When you're committed to doing it,
right,
and you do it, then it happens. He also has raised actor salaries,
right,
as,
yeah,
well.
Yeah.
So he's committed to... He really takes the job as a leader in the field very seriously.
Yeah,
it's not just he's a leader of an institution. It's not just he's a leader of a professional theater school. It's that he's one of the leaders in American theater.
Yeah, no.
And watch what I do, and hopefully it will resonate with throughout the field.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's true. There's people talk about the Yale Mafia or the Yale. Even having a Yale degree, there's so many directors and actors out in the field. And, you know, there's obviously something to there being an elitism, you know, the charge of elitism. But I feel like if you're going to be an elite, make the, you know, the highest, you can afford to have the highest ideals. And I think that you should.
Well, that's where his family is.
Yeah, like exactly.
Too. He grew up, you know, with that commitment of duty and responsibility and civic responsibility. And
his father was, as you say, George
Bundy.
Right.
But his uncle, Bill Bundy. But his entire family has that legacy of duty.
Right.
And he continues this in the arts. The funny thing about James is that he's very matter of fact about it. So when I in a way applauded him for his activities, he was saying, well, why are you doing this? This is something that we should be doing.
Right.
And it's, you know, of course we're not.
Right, right.
Frank, of course you've been following James Bundy's career for a while. Were there elements of your conversation with him that surprised you?
Gee, that's a good question. And I hate when I say that's a good question. Not really. He was very frank about the need for a new facility there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, literally, Yale has terrible physical plant.
Yeah.
He acknowledged that. It has half of the square footage that many schools who are doing what he is doing should have.
Right.
You can look at state schools that have better physical plants.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a question that I've pursued for decades, literally, with the presidents of Yale.
Right.
And it's not that they don't want to do it. It's a question of funding. But at a certain point, they have to do it, whether the donations are there, if they want to keep the level that Yale has achieved over the last century.
Right. And that's a facility that also extends to Yale Reps Theater, or the Rep Theater is
yes, both.
Both, right.
On the plus side, James was very optimistic.
Okay.
I said, our issue isn't going out to October. Is there anything that you want to announce?
Right.
And he had a long pause.
Yeah.
I'm hoping, and he's certainly hoping, that there'll be some news in regards to this tremendous need, because if they don't have it, they're going to go behind.
Right.
It's fascinating that, you know, there's a lot of talk in the American theater, not necessarily around colleges, but around theaters, about how it's so much easier to raise money for a building than for institutions and operating expenses. And it's like somehow he threaded the needle in the other way, which we can't argue with that. It'd be great to have both.
Maybe
he will.
I hope that there'll be a Meryl Streep Theater on Chapel Street in downtown New Haven.
Yes.
But I don't know. It could be Sidney Lipschitz, theater.
Yeah. Right, right. Well, whoever gives more money, right?
Whoever gives more money, and God bless him, whoever does.
Yeah. So we also have an interview in the issue, a Q&A with Carrie Perloff, another artist director. One of the many who's leaving in this coming season, and that's a... We didn't talk about whether we were going to talk about the huge transitions going on across the field. Les Waters from Actors Theater of Louisville,
yeah.
Mark Masterson, South Coast.
Yep.
The list goes on. Tony Taccone, both of the big Bay Area theaters are losing artistic directors.
These things come in waves almost.
Do they?
And
yeah.
It's like it's almost time.
I wasn't here for the last wave, so I don't remember. I don't remember the last wave, at least.
Yeah. at least for me, it was during a period when Darko Trejnik came and Michael Price at Goodspeed Opera House was leaving.
Okay.
But there were a lot of other artistic directors around the country going through transition.
Now
we're in another one.
Yeah.
So it's a great opportunity, especially when we step back and look at diversity, at women, at artists of color. Uh-huh. And there will be more representations in these very pivotal positions.
Yeah, no, it's a great opportunity.
And in this issue, we were also talking about season planning. Yeah. That was our frame for this particular season preview issue.
Right.
Of these leaders that we're discussing, are there things that they are doing for season planning that serve as a model for the rest of the field?
Well, I mean, I think... I haven't looked in detail at Yale's season, but I think I think Yale has gender parity in their season, and I do think what happens at theaters that do a lot of classics, for instance, I believe Oregon Shakespeare has committed to at least 50% people of color on stage, and because they do so many dead white males, actually only about 3 Shakespeares a year, but places like that, including Oregon, have made a commitment to hiring more women directors and directors of color. Because if the writer's going to, you can't change who the writer is if you're going to do a classic, but you could at least hire diverse folks to be on stage and to in the artistic positions, designers as well.
I'm fascinated and so encouraged by the number of new plays.
Yes.
Because for years, whenever I interviewed managing directors, they said, you know, the new plays are hard to sell.
Yeah.
We can have maybe one a season.
Right.
And now that's no longer the mantra.
It doesn't seem to be. It seems to be.
And I think audiences maybe over time have developed this interest because new works, I think, energize institutions. And but you can't do it just overnight.
No.
You just can't put on a new play once a season and think that suddenly you're going to have an audience that's going to demand new plays.
Right.
So I think this could be a result of regional theaters who have stuck with it and finally found that their audiences are indeed responding to new work and are energized by it instead of seeing another production of Midsummer's Night Dream.
I think The Goodman is another place where they've made a strategic commitment to a more diverse season, but also to new plays specifically. They've looked at their contributed versus earned income and changed the calculus so that they really... to make new plays happen, which they're committed to, and it's a fairly large theater. They funded it. They found funding for it. I do think Deep Tran wrote a wonderful piece about season planning, how some new artistic directors who are already in their positions, either just brand new or fairly new, how they planned their first season, which was fascinating. One of them, speaking of giant theaters, is the Guthrie, where Joe Hodge has one of the biggest houses in the country to fill. It's like, talk about a barn. It's huge. So to program for that theater has always been a challenge for everyone. He's done a great job of doing sort of large, splashy musicals people will like. I guess you could call Sunday in the Park with George that, right? As well as he announced a series, Level 9, which is, I believe it's on the 9th floor. I think there's a hole in the studio for the Guthrie. And I think in the past, the Guthrie would sort of do co-productions, but it was a bit of an arm's length relationship. Mm-hmm. I think there's much more of he has a resident company there. And the Guthrie sort of putting its brand forward with stuff that's in the studio. So,
and then look what Eric Ting is doing
in
California at the California Shakespeare.
Right.
The place is called Shakespeare, and yet he's doing work both in classics but in new plays as well that are really shaking things up. Mm-hmm. And you get some of the old guard that likes the way things have always been.
Yeah.
But I think in the long run, he's going to benefit it. He's a terrific director and a very smart
That's
guy.
Right. He was at Long Wharf.
He was an associate artistic director of Long Wharf, and he's doing terrific there.
Yeah, yeah.
And for those who don't know, Deep, who wrote that piece, is our associate editor at American Theater and also producer of our podcast.
She's in the room.
She's in the room with us, listening to us on headphones, ramble away.
I think that's our cue to wrap up this part of the show. And we have a few recommendations. This one, because it's our season preview, we're mainly going to be looking forward to things. We have seen some things, but we want to tell you what we're looking forward to seeing in the coming weeks, months, Russ?
This weekend, I am looking forward to seeing Describe the Night by Rajiv Joseph, the world premiere at the Alley Theater in Houston. Pretty excited for that. And then it's going to be in New York in November. So maybe I'll get to see it twice.
Right?
At the Atlantic, yep.
Now, you won't be seeing it at the Alley, per se, right?
Right. They're currently off-site. They're at the University of Houston temporarily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have a wonderful story Trevor Buffoni wrote about how they opened that show on time despite Hurricane Harvey.
And I think they just had a talk back addressing how they accomplished that incredible feat.
Yeah, you can find the story online as well. Yep. We did about three stories, I think, about the Houston, the aftermath of Houston. You know, there's no wood to knock, but, you know, Hurricane Irma had minimal damage to theaters. Hurricane Maria, we don't have any member theaters in Puerto Rico.
Still devastating, of course.
Yes. No, yeah. I focused on the theater part, but I will say in Houston, most theaters were fine. One of the major theaters in the country, the Alley, happened to be probably the one that were most affected of any, you know, any arts institution in the country. So the Alley could use our support. And so I look forward to what you think of Rajiv's new play. It sounds fascinating, actually.
Yes.
Yeah. Sort of Stepardian, you might
say.
Yes. Frank, what are you looking forward to?
Oh, I think I should throw something from Connecticut. Actually, a personal one. They're doing what is being called a revisal at the Goodspeed Opera House of a musical that was a big flop in the 80s called Rags, which I did not see, but I saw what when they, you know, adapted it or tried to improve it when it was at the Jewish theater, American Jewish theater, in the a few years later, and I loved it. It was a problematic show. It has a terrific score by Charles Strauss and lyrics by Stephen Schwartz. And they've completely rewritten. They got a new book writer, David Thompson, who wrote the Scottsboro's Boys.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a terrific writer. And so I'm fingers crossed that his book, and Schwartz tells me that he's written 80% new lyrics.
Wow.
And so in a sense, it's an almost new show. And it's being directed by a terrific director, Rob Ruggiero, who's done remarkable work.
And you said what theater is that?
Goodspeed Opera House.
Oh, Goodspeed.
And
it's
Rags. And the score is dynamic.
Yeah, I was going to ask you. I saw a production of it in L.A. that I really liked quite a lot, a small, intimate production. I don't think it was revised, but it predated Ragtime.
Yes.
And it's about
the immigrant experience.
The immigrant experience,
And which is so relevant now.
Yeah.
And I have a feeling, I don't think they planned it because they were looking at it for several years now.
Right.
But, boy, is it timely as well.
Yeah.
And it sort of reminds audiences who we are and where we came from.
If I recall correctly, it is mostly about the Jewish American experience, but it has the African American experience as well, and that the rags, the garment industry, the ragtime, is that correct?
They've also included the Italian-American immigrant experience. So it goes, originally it was conceived way back as sort of a sequel to Fiddler on the Roof.
Right, right. Like what happens
because
to them
Joe Stein wrote the original book
and
Rags.
That's right.
But Joe abandoned that early and created Rags. And it was a, he just wanted to tell too much of a story. There were a lot of things going on.
There were.
It was just
it's
too
true.
Much. So this, I think, is I'm looking forward to. Hopefully it's a streamed-down, focused, and thrilling show. And I know the music is going to be wonderful. And I also love Broadway, The Band's Visit. I saw it off-Broadway.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's just remarkable.
I didn't see it. I'm looking forward to that a lot. I'll put that on my looking forward to list. I was going to mention for my looking forward to list Oedipus El Rey, which you've seen, Frank, and had good things to say about.
Yes.
Luis Alfaro is someone I go back way back to L.A. He's probably about my age, and he came up as an artist there, writing a little bit about the Chicano experience, but mostly about the queer experience more. It was his focus. And he got on this, you know, not a kick. I would just say he developed this this body of work adapting Greek plays to the Chicano East L.A. specifically world, which he more or less grew up with. He's El Salvadoran, if I recall correctly, but He might be Mexican American, but he grew up in a part of LA which was a mix of El Salvadoran and Mexican, and it wasn't necessarily East LA. But in any case, he did Electricidad, which was Electra. He did Mojada, which is going to open next year. At Oregon Shakes. And Oedipus El Rey is one that's been around. It was a National New Play Network rolling premiere years ago.
Right.
It was in LA and various places. And now it's coming to New York. I couldn't be more excited about just to see his work. I don't know that he's been produced here in New York, or at least I know his Greek stuff hasn't been here. So I'm looking forward to that a lot, and also just hopefully I'll run into him in the lobby and say hello. Looking forward to that a lot. I will also just quickly say that my favorite fictional Shakespeare that I've rediscovered recently, they've only had put one series on. Or one season, as the Brits call it, a series of one season.
Right.
Upstart Crow. David Mitchell, who's this very funny British comic from a show called Mitchell and Webb, plays the bard. And it's Ben Elton wrote it. And Ben Elton's the guy who did The Thin Blue Line. I don't know if anybody knows Popcorn, a play called Popcorn. Wonderful TV writer. It's very on the nose. It's very kind of crudely funny, but also very smart. It deals a lot with, as a contemporary take on Shakespeare would, the fact that women weren't part of it, the fact that there's very retrograde views about women, and it deals very matter-of-factly with that, because one of his assistants is a woman who keeps wanting to get on stage. This is going to be a persistent theme with Shakespeare fictionalizations. Anyway, I've only been able to find it on a Roku app called BritBox. So I don't know if you can find this show. I think the first episode of it, again, it's called Upstart Crow. Highly recommend it. Might not be to everyone's taste, but if you like British sitcoms and a lot of inside jokes about Shakespeare, about his sexuality, about the sexual, it goes there basically, and it's very funny. I highly recommend it. And it always closes with Anne Hathaway. He and his wife. Like just sort of musing about something, him giving her or she giving him an idea, like what about that Macbeth? That would be a good play, you know. So that kind of thing, like it's very funny. Highly recommend it.
Then there's the Hugh Laurie Rowan Atkinson sketch in which Hugh Laurie has written a version of Hamlet that's 8 hours long or something.
Yeah.
And so Rowan Atkinson's character is his producer and telling him what to cut, and so.
Okay.
They narrowed down to be or not to be, and it's originally this long,
okay.
flowing line. Yeah,
That's not on the Blackadder show. No,
it's separate from Blackadder. Okay, all right.
Well, anyway, that takes us down a digression there. But anyway, yes. We started with Shakespeare, end with Shakespeare, always Shakespeare. Thank you, Frank, for coming by, and Russ. And this show is produced by and engineered by Deep Tran. And you can find links to all the things we talked about online, and we're available to subscribe in iTunes. Rate us there. It helps people find the show. Google Play and Stitcher as well.
And American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group.
That is also true.
Yes.
All right. Thanks. Till next time.
See you at the theater.